Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where we try to welcome you with open minds and open hearts, no matter where you are on this journey of life, this spiritual sacred journey. You are welcome here, no matter your sexual orientation, or your gender orientation, your sexual preference, the color of your eyes, the color of your hair, your ability or inabilities, your ethnicity, or where you are on that broad spectrum of from atheist to Christian and everything in between. Welcome. If this is one of your first Sundays here, there will be a chance later on in the service where you may introduce yourselves if you want to. You will not be forced to. And we always encourage you to come back to more than one service because sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's part-time minister. Sometimes people from within our congregation do the service, and sometimes we have speakers from out from the larger community. The opening words, oh, and of course I always want to draw your attention to the fact that we are sharing our offering with, this month we are sharing it with Beacon House until the end of the year, I believe. The opening words are these from Unitarian Universalist Minister Wayne Arneson. We come together today seeking a reality beyond our narrow selves that binds us in compassion, love, and understanding to other human beings and to the interdependent web of all living things. May our hearts and minds be opened to the power and the insight that weave together the scattered threads of our experience and help us remember the wholeness, with a capital W, of which we are a part. May unity and peace abide within us. May wholeness and joy touch our hearts. May kindness and compassion fill our universe and reverence fill our days. May we see the light that shines in all. I have several Buddhist stories to share with you this morning, not so many words of my own that may make you happy or not. The first one, and the stories are all from books by Sylvia Boorstein. I don't know if any of you know that name, a well-known Buddhist teacher. She writes, "A magazine journalist interviewed me on the telephone for an article about newly emerging religious forms. He wanted to know what I thought about people mixing and matching religions." This should ring a bell. I responded clearly disingenuously, given that I am both a Buddhist teacher and an observant Jew. Are people doing that? The interviewer said, "Yes, indeed. People are just taking what they like and making up their own religions, like salad religions. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Whatever they like, they mix it in." Now, Unitarian Universalists, these are my words now, not Boorstein's, are often accused of doing exactly that. And we have sometimes been called the salad religion. Yes, people are doing that. Whatever they like, they mix it in, the interviewer said. Do you think it's bad or good? I said, well, I don't know if it's bad or good. If people are doing it, maybe it's a reflection of what the psychoanalyst Erik Erikson called the American character. He believed we are inspired by what we think of as the pioneer spirit. Like cowboys, independent, able to go out on the range alone, taking the best of what's available and making it work. And maybe it also means that people are realizing that what seemed important to them in their life, materialism and consumerism, doesn't work at all to make a happy heart. It actually makes an unhappy heart and an unhappy world. And maybe people are discovering that they really need something that speaks to the essence of their being. something that connects them directly with conscious intention to the truth of their experience so that their lives become meaningful. So maybe it's a good thing. The interviewer said, but do you think it could be dangerous? I said, I don't know if it could be dangerous. I suppose there might be a pitfall. What would the pitfall be? I replied, well, if you were in a religion all by yourself, you would have nobody to encourage you if you were making progress to tell you that's great. And you also wouldn't have anybody to tell you that you were deluding yourself and that nothing was happening. Then he asked, what's supposed to happen? What's supposed to happen? What's supposed to happen is that our vision becomes transformed. We begin to see with increasing clarity how much confusion and suffering there is in our own minds and hearts. And we also see the ways in which our own personal suffering creates suffering in the world. That part is heartbreaking and totally daunting, but that's not all. We also get to see the extraordinariness of life, how amazing it is that life exists and continually recreates itself as an incredible, spectacular, mind-boggling, lawful way when we see clearly. Our awe and our thanksgiving for the very fact that life is happening makes it impossible to do anything other than address the pain in the world, to try to heal it, to hope never to add one single extra drop of pain and suffering to it. As our understanding increases, our hearts become more responsive. We become the compassionate people we were meant to be. That's the whole point of practice. That's what's supposed to happen. There was a very long pause. Because I had gone from measured, thoughtful teacher to thundering preacher in almost 30 seconds. Very good, the interviewer said. It is good. Borstein concludes, I'm grateful to the journalist who asked, what's supposed to happen? I got to hear how passionately I believe that paying attention, mindfulness, shows itself as goodness and kindness, as concern for others, as concern for the whole world. What's supposed to happen? Sylvia Borstein asked that poor journalist. She was responding to his quite innocent question about what's supposed to happen when we open ourselves up to ideas and practices from different religious or faith or sacred traditions, especially when we mix and match religions, as that interviewer put it. When we discover, for example, meditation in the Buddhist tradition, even though we are Unitarian Universalists, and within that tradition might even be atheists or humanists or agnostics or don't know and don't care kind of folks, when it comes to the big questions of life, is something supposed to happen when we gather together on a Sunday morning in this space? Well, yes. Something is supposed to happen. Maybe you will learn something. Maybe you will be moved to put a little more money into the offering plate. Maybe you will have an aha moment about white supremacy, for example, or about what it is like to have a skin color other than white. Maybe you will realize how important a broad liberal religious education is for children. Maybe you will be moved by a piece of music. Maybe a quiet meditative service will help you, especially at this time of year, realize the importance of slowing down, relaxing, breathing, giving thanks for life, paying attention. What I always hope will happen here on a Sunday morning, well, maybe not every Sunday morning, but at least once in a while, is exactly what Borstein said. What's supposed to happen is that our vision becomes transformed and we begin to see with increasing clarity how much confusion and suffering there is in our own minds and our hearts. And we also see the ways in which our personal suffering creates suffering in the world. But she didn't end there, remember. She went on to talk about the extraordinariness of life. We become the compassionate people we were meant to be, I hope, when we're in here on Sunday mornings. Maybe we only think of it about it for a few moments, but that's the end goal for me, is that we all become more compassionate. That's what's supposed to happen. How could I have forgotten this? I know this. I know how valuable meditation is, if only for a few minutes a day. I don't know if any of you read the Isthmus newspaper, the weekly newspaper in Madison, which used to be so much better. But that's another subject. I thought I'd stuck it in my pile here. This current one has an article about the police in Madison. Not all of them, but some of them have been doing a pilot program, actually, of meditation and yoga and mindfulness. And there was resistance, but the results so far have been pretty outstanding. So you can find it's current issue, so you can find it through Wednesday, most anywhere. How could I have forgotten that there is clarity to be had in life, that I need not wander around aimlessly in confusion all the time? A few weeks ago, the Committee on Ministry asked for your feedback on ministry because it was time for my annual performance review, and thank you to those of you who responded to that. One of you made a comment about how my reflections could be confusing and hard to follow. I hope that that is not generally the case. However, when I thought about my reflections after the months following the November 8th, 2016 elections, I had to agree that some of those reflections were indeed confusing, not as focused as I would have liked. I, of course, blame Trump. I just blame him for everything that has happened in my life over the last almost 13 months. How could this have happened? Not my blaming, but how could that person be our so-called leader? I have never been so depressed and so frightened as I have been during this past year. I have never been so confused and overwhelmed. Everything I have worked for all my life is being dismantled and taken apart. But I don't have to be stuck in these states of being. Buddhism offers me mind-changing options. Months ago, I chose the title and the subject for this morning's service, so perhaps I knew on some intuitive level that I needed to reclaim my inner Buddhist, and that by doing so, I might find my way out of confusion. The first time I ever meditated, I was well into adulthood. I was in seminary. It was a class that I was so thrilled to get into. It was my first semester, too. And I got into a class taught by, and we had to kind of audition for it, taught by one of my honeys, my heroines, my role models, Joanna Macy. And some of you know who that is. I have talked about Joanna Macy before. She is well known in the Buddhist world. But she is also well known in systems theory, the systems theory world, whatever that is, and the world of deep ecology. She has a whole bunch of degrees. She went to Chernobyl and counseled people there after the nuclear reactor disaster. The description of the class never mentioned anything about Buddhism or meditation. And yet, in one of the first classes, Joanna announced that we would be meditating in every class for 15 to 20 minutes. I was not happy. More about this in a few minutes. Sylvia Borstein writes, "I was sitting at my computer writing when my friend Martha called to say that her brother Jack's illness had just taken a turn for the much worse. I felt sad, mostly for Martha, whom I knew well, but also for her brother, a man I'd met. I said what I hoped were consoling words. As soon as our conversation ended, I went back to writing, eager to resume because I'd had what I thought was a really good idea, just as the phone rang. And then I realized I'd forgotten the point I was about to make, and I heard myself think, so inconvenient of Jack to get worse just today. I felt my heart wince at the thought, and then I stopped. I turned off the computer. I lit a candle. I sat in my rocking chair and I looked out the window. I thought about Jack and his children and his grandchildren. I thought about Martha, who often described herself as Jack's baby sister, and about Martha's mother, almost 90, facing the loss of her son. And pretty soon I was thinking about other people I knew who were suffering. And eventually I did some of my rituals. I said, may all beings everywhere be happy and peaceful and come to the end of suffering. And I felt better. I was glad to be alive. I thought about my family. And at some point I had the thought, go back and finish the writing. But no impulse arose in me to move. I felt peaceful and very happy. I love it that what my heart wants most to do is console or appreciate or encourage. It feels better in relationship. I imagine it always on the lookout for an object, a frightened friend or my own chagrined self, the world around me, that it can connect with. And I love it that it reminds me. My heart, my own heart tells me, turn off the computer, light a candle, pay attention. If you take nothing else away from this morning, try to remember Sylvia Borstein's emphasis on turning it all off and being kind to yourself. Maybe. A few days ago, feeling especially overwhelmed and confused, I took a long walk. I took a route that I know well. I almost got lost because I walked right by the street where I usually turn. Now, I wouldn't have really been lost. I was still within Madison. As long as you can see the Capitol, you're not going to get lost. I wasn't daydreaming exactly. What I seemed to be doing was taking a mindless mindfulness walk. I didn't give it that designation until later that day, or maybe even the next day, when I realized how calm I felt, not overwhelmed at all. Now, maybe I'd had the perfect amount of caffeine. I don't know. But I like to think it was that mindless mindfulness walk. And following that long walk, I wasn't confused any longer. Well, I'm always confused, but not in the same way. Confusion is relative, and we're all confused most of the time, let's face it. My hope for you this morning is that you will leave here at least slightly less confused than when you entered. And I hope that you will be relaxed and not agitated, because there is so much to do. And I hope these states of being will stay with you during the entire holiday season. I want you to be able to see more clearly what is real and important. I want you to reach a state of equanimity, at least for a little while. That first meditation experience of mine in Joanna Macy's class, I fell sound asleep. When the time was up, Joanna asked us for feedback. I, being the know-it-all that I can be, harumphed that it was a big waste of time. Somehow I missed the fact that she was one of the world's foremost Buddhist teachers. She looked, I said I had simply slept through it all. She looked me in the eye. She shook her head and said, you obviously aren't getting enough sleep. Once you catch on to the art of meditation and realize what the results are from regularly meditating, you won't fall asleep. In the meantime, go to bed earlier. Well, there were two positive results from that first meditating experience, although I didn't know it, one of them then. Eventually, I became, while I was in seminary, part of a Sangha, S-A-N-G-H-A, which is a community. It's not exactly the translation of the Pali language, but it's a Buddhist community where they meditate. And then the other interesting thing that came out of this was one of my classmates, a woman named Lilia. She really got into meditating, and especially the part about don't worry, be happy. And Lily was from Colombia, and even though she'd lived in this country for a number of years, she still had her Colombian accent. So in her wonderful accent, which I will not try to duplicate, she came up with a theory of worrying. Every time she was worried about something, she would say to herself, yes, that's worrisome. I will worry about that on Friday night at 8 p.m. And it seemed to work, for her, at any rate. During our next two meditation times, try to stay awake, but also try not to direct your thoughts much beyond thinking about your breath, or you might try focusing on a favorite place, a mountain, a beach, a flower, a bird, but just let those random thoughts come up. It's okay. The grocery lists, the holiday shopping lists, what to get those, difficult to know what to give them, people, your cousin's wife's heart problems. Let monkey mind thoughts, that's called monkey mind. There's so much going on up there. Just let them surface. View them for a second for what they are, and then watch them. Just watch them exit stage left, so to speak. Now, the good news is that you've already done one meditation time during our regularly scheduled order of service. We always include a silent meditation. So we're going to do a couple more. Just relax. Three things. Relax, breathe, pay attention to breathing, and pay attention to what is really going on. As good free-thinking Unitarians, now I'm just speaking about the Unitarian side of our heritage, not so much the Universalist side, we tend to scoff at anything that seems to be irrational, illogical, not reasoned through. Unfortunately, sometimes we put meditation into this category, thinking it is not logical or sensible. Well, realizing this, I think you can appreciate why I had to laugh at a mistake I made in the first draft of today's order of service. Instead of a few moments of silence, I had put a few moments of science. I'll bet some of you are wishing right now that I would do a few minutes of science rather than a few moments of silence. Relax, breathe, and pay attention to what is happening. Again from Borstein. Well, I think I said these are all from Borstein. She talks about, she spends a lot of time in airports because, lucky her, she lives part of the time in Northern California and part of the time in France. She's French. She speaks fluent French, like a little girl, you know, just learned to pet. So here she is in the airport, and she writes, I was wending my way slowly along with hundreds of people back and forth through the cordoned off lanes of an airport security lane when I became aware of the conversation of the two people right behind me. It's your fault. What do you mean it's your fault? It's your fault. That's what I mean. It's your fault we're late. No, it's not. Prove it to me that it's my fault. I don't have to prove anything to you. It just is. I glanced behind me as if looking beyond them and saw that they were young, casually dressed, and apparently, was it tennis rackets, golf gear, were going on holiday together. The ping pong recriminations continued. Your fault. No, yours. I had a momentary impulse to turn around and say, listen to me. It does not matter one bit whose fault it is. Either you'll be in time for your flight or you won't. And if you miss this flight, there will be others. What's more, you don't know that this flight is the best one to be on. Perhaps this one will have engine trouble and the next one will arrive safely. Relax. You are ruining the beginning of your holiday with a useless skirmish. Of course, I didn't say anything. I think I could have gotten away with it if I had done it sweetly enough. But I imagine them telling someone later, "You won't believe what this wacky little old woman in the airport," and so on. Anyway, eavesdropping and intruding are both impolite, even if unintended and well-meaning. So I took off my jacket and my shoes, and I pushed them through the x-ray machine along with my carry-on bag and my computer and all of that, retrieving my possessions on the other side, balancing on one foot and then the other to, you know, put on my shoes. I noticed the couple in front of me also just emerged through the sensor gate, taking a moment to kiss each other, give each other a hug. I was amused by the thought that they were congratulating each other for having made it through the security hurdle unscathed. It was the briefest of exchanges of affection, but it was there, right in the middle of getting redressed. Then I thought, I should call the attention of the arguing folks behind me to the kissing folks in front of me. Look, I could tell them, here is another possibility. In fact, there are only two possibilities in any given moment. You can kiss or you can fight. Kissing is better. Of course, I said nothing. Again, I said nothing and I went on to my flight. But I knew then, as I know now, that in situations where I feel stressed, I might behave like the couple behind me. But right now, when I presumably understand that struggling with anything to make it be other than what it is creates suffering, if my mind becomes confused, broadsided by a challenge that upsets it, even a minor one, such as I'll miss my plane, which is relatively minor, I forget at least for a while what I know. But I forget less often, and I remember sooner that I've forgotten. This really resonated with me because I had obviously also forgotten about the basics of Buddhism. There are three things that are fundamentally true. The Buddhists seem to like threes, which is interesting. Trinity, threes. Three things the Buddha called the three characteristics of experience. One, everything is always changing. Two, there is a cause and effect, lawfulness that governs all unfolding experience. And three, what we do matters, but we are not in charge. I didn't define equanimity. I didn't know if I needed to, but I think you probably all know that's calmness. It's balanced. It's a balanced state of being, equanimity. It's a beautiful word, I think. And it is the foundation, the base upon which we build loving kindness, goodwill to all. And it just delights me that this is the time of year when we hear a lot about goodwill to all. Except if you're unenlightened, it says that those old carols say goodwill to men, but the word all fits in there quite nicely. So I really like that here it's all around us, that word goodwill. Here are three examples of loving kindness, see, three again, that you can ponder when you find time to meditate at least for a few moments. If you read my newsletter column for December, those of you with young children especially, I get this back a lot. There's no time to meditate when you have children at home. Bathrooms are very useful. And you only need a few moments of meditation a day to kind of get unmuddled and unconfused. Three examples of loving kindness or goodwill: appreciation, friendliness, and consolation. which, another word for consolation, sometimes is compassion. So one more reading and one more meditation. Assuming I can find anything. I didn't manage to get unmuddled for all of them today. Again, Sylvia's on in an airport, on an airplane. And this is about the friendliness thing. This is about ordinary, what she calls ordinary goodwill. Also remember that there are only three ways to respond, right? Three again, to anything we experience, right? Three ways. Positive, negative, neutral. So that's tied into this too. So here she is in the airport. An overnight flight from San Francisco to Paris, which takes more than 10 hours. So during those long hours, she gets up to stretch and walk down the aisle, and she sees men and women, old and young, large and small, all unknown to me, some traveling with young children, all trying to figure out how to be comfortable. I see them wrapped up in airplane blankets, scrunched up into whatever position of repose they can organize for themselves, leaning on each other if they are traveling together, or trying not to lean on each other if they aren't. Often a man or woman is patrolling the aisle across from me holding an infant against his or her chest and moving in that, you know, rocking way we move when we're holding a baby. I feel a pleasant intimacy with them. I'm also trying to stay comfortable. I'm not frightened for them or for me because I happen to be relaxed about flying, and I assume we will land successfully, but still, I wish them well. I enjoy the feeling of my own good-heartedness. In fact, in that moment of mental hand-holding, love that phrase, mental hand-holding, all those people look a bit more familiar than ordinary strangers. That moment of easy, impartial, benevolent connection. That makes me, buoys my mind. I feel better as I sit back down in my seat. That's friendliness. That's the first, one of the components of loving kindness. Then compassion, also called consolation. A man died suddenly in the middle of a flight I was on, from Paris to San Francisco. I didn't see it happen, but I knew something was wrong because the plane icon on the TV map on the screen in the back of the seat in front of me reversed direction. I don't look at those. Soon after that, while the people all around me were showing one another the map and discussing what might be happening, the pilot announced that there had been a medical emergency and requested that any medical personnel come forward. Seymour, and this is Sylvia Borstein's husband, is a physician. Seymour responded, as he has on previous flights when there's been a call for a physician. He was gone for an hour. The flight just continued as if nothing had gone wrong. The attendants served lunch, we watched movies. But then the icon on the TV turned west again, and I assumed correctly, I later learned, that the passenger had died and that landing for emergency medical care wasn't necessary. She wondered about the family. She wondered if this person, it was a man, had been traveling alone or if he had friends or family with him. Eventually, she, you know, finds all this out from her husband. But she, this is the consolation part of loving kindness. She just sat quietly and after a few minutes heard her mind on its own beginning to recite wishes of consolation. May the dead person's consciousness, whatever it is, wherever it is now, be at ease. May that person's family on this plane or wherever they are be strengthened in their loss. May all the people on this plane who have been frightened feel at ease. May I feel at ease. May we land safely. This is my personal version of praying. That you send these thoughts out, these loving kindness thoughts of consolation and compassion. It also is a very good example of believing in the interconnected web. And the third way that loving kindness exhibits itself. Her third story, and this is in pleasant situations. She says, we need equanimity, even in pleasant experiences. She was with her husband in the Pyrenees. They live in France, come on. And they weren't skiing. They were just there on a mountain to watch the skiers and eat at a nice restaurant because they were kind of beyond the age of doing downhill skiing, at least intense downhill skiing, when all of a sudden she said to her husband, well, we could ski again. This is an easy hill. They were standing at the bottom of the beginner slope. Next year, let's ski. No, he said, we can't. We're old. It's not worth the risk. We could break something. But look, it's so easy. It would be so much fun to put on the skis again. We'd choose a sunny day, like today. Forget it. It would be ridiculous. Your back isn't so good. You have bursitis in your shoulder. Last year, you pinched a nerve in your neck. Let's go have lunch on the deck, and we'll watch the skiing. Well, eventually, she's a longtime Buddhist teacher. Equanimity returned, as she puts it, and she thought, what was really going on was I was peeved about getting old. And then, this brought into play the fact that even in situations where you're really happy and everything's going great, you still have to bring that monkey mind in and say, okay, maybe I won't do this ever again in my life. But I used to do it. And I love watching the people doing it now. And you have to be where you are right now and accept that. That's what the Buddhists mean when they say pay attention to what's going on right now. That's one of the things they mean. You have to work with where you are and what you are. And it's also tied in with letting go, not clinging, which is the root of all suffering, according to the Buddhists. Don't worry, be happy. Don't cling, let go. And isn't life all about letting go of everything, eventually? That's not necessarily a bad thing. Borstein says, I love knowing that all of these qualities of loving kindness and then all of their derivatives, compassion, generosity, mindfulness, all of these are natural. They're built-in tendencies of humans. There's no built-in tendency that says you're going to play the piano. I mean, there can be genetic things that help you be more skillful at learning. There's no built-in tendency that says you're going to be a good tennis player, necessarily. But these qualities of mind are built in. Human beings do not need lessons in friendliness. We are relational when we aren't frightened into self-absorption. That was me after November 8th for the past over a year. Being frightened into self-absorption. We've all been frightened since 9/11, and we're stuck, some of us. But when we aren't frightened, we're relational. We take care of each other. We look out for each other. And as Borstein says, I love it that all of these qualities seem like gifts that people give each other, because they are gifts that people give each other. At the end of the this wonderful so-called children's book is a note about the author, which wouldn't surprise you. And he says at the very end of it all, with quiet puddle, I mean still water, there on the page, John Muth reminds us, it's well known, and this is about one of the stories in the book, and so he talks about that for a minute, and then he says, this illuminates our fundamental spiritual dilemma. Against the enormous odds we face, how should we act? And then he answers his own question. Kindness works. Generosity works. Compassion works. Not every time, but always. In the words, again, from Wayne Arneson. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, and the path is never clear. And the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down, there's another truth. You are not alone. May it be so. Go in peace, greet your neighbors, drink coffee. I think there's a meeting today, humanist meeting. Always a meeting.